Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Obama's rebuke of Ted Cruz's call for patrolling Muslim neighborhoods, which Obama called un-American, adding, "I just left a country that engages in that kind of neighborhood surveillance," which, by the way, the father of Senator Cruz escaped from for America, the land of the free. David Shanza, professor of the practice and director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security at Duke University, joins us to discuss why he thinks Cruz's proposals are exactly the wrong way to keep America safe. Then, with Jeb Bush's endorsement of Ted Cruz today, we will examine the kind of advisors Cruz has assembled for his presidency, which is looking more and more like a long shot. Michael Hiltzik, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times, joins us to discuss Cruz's choice of the person most cited as the leading architect of the 2008 financial crash, and Michael Hiltzik's latest article at the Los Angeles Times, "Ted Cruz Just Named Phil Graham His Economic Advisor. Here's Graham's Economic Legacy." Then finally, we'll get an assessment of whether there is a possible path for Bernie Sanders to the Democratic presidential nomination following his decisive wins with 75% of the votes in the Idaho and Utah caucuses, and speak with Bill Zimmerman, an author, longtime activist, and one of the nation's most experienced political media consultants. With Sanders netting 76 to Hillary's 55 delegates last night, Bill joins us to discuss Hillary Clinton's delegate lead following her big win in Arizona and whether the movement that has coalesced around Bernie Sanders will become a potent political force in the future. And joining us now is David Shanza, who's associate professor of the practice and director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security in the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. He served in the executive branch as special counsel to the Office of General Counsel at the Department of Defense and trial attorney for the United States Department of Justice. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Shanza.
Happy to be with you, Evan.
And what's your sense then of obviously, I think the president, I think very effectively put down Ted Cruz's proposals, which are pretty shocking in themselves. But now the AP is reporting that French intelligence, Iraqi intelligence, and other officials are now saying there are about 400 fighters trained by Daesh, the Islamic State, to attack Europe, who have been seeded into Europe along with these refugee flows, and that they'll be conducting waves of bloodshed. So do you expect what happened in Brussels to be a part of a continuum?
Well, I'm loath to make predictions. Obviously, there's a big problem in Europe. ISIS is really beginning to lose part of its caliphate and is going to continue to lash out to try to undermine the effort that's going against it. So this is not surprising. I don't know. We're going to see more attacks, but you know whether it's going to be a large-scale wave or not, I tend to doubt it. We tend to get a little scared after events like this, and we think the enemy is invincible and stronger than it really is. But that's the nature of terrorism. That's what it's designed to try to do.
Well, but there does seem to be a fundamental difference between what happens in, particularly in Belgium, and the United States, which flies in the face of Ted Cruz's proposals to patrol Muslim neighborhoods here in the United States. Not that there really are Muslim neighborhoods here in the United States, and that's the whole point, isn't it? There is a Muslim neighborhood, Molenbeek, in Brussels, that has been the source of a number of attacks. The weapons that were used in Charlie Hebdo came from there. Most of the fighters, the jihadis that attacked Paris on November the 13th, they came from there. And, of course, we've seen this these recent attacks as well, launched literally out of this neighborhood in Brussels, so within a mile or so of the very capital of Europe, the EU Commission's headquarters.
Absolutely. I mean, there are, and people have been writing about this for quite a while, the Muslim population in Europe is different in so many different ways from our Muslim American population. And you named one of them in terms of the geographic distribution. Other than, you know, some places outside of Detroit, Dearborn, some small pockets of New York, place in California, maybe New Jersey. You know, you hardly have any places in America that are identifiably Muslim in the way you could actually patrol a street. Not that that would do any good, even if there were such neighborhoods, because what we're really seeing is most of the radicalization that is taking place among very small numbers of Muslim Americans is really taking place on the Internet. So I have no idea what Mr. Cruz was talking about in terms of some sort of patrol and social control by law enforcement to try and impose its will on a particular population. It just shows, I have to say, an ignorance of what the structure of the community is. And the other difference is, as you pointed out, you know, it's a lot harder to emigrate to the United States. Muslim Americans came here from many different countries, principally, like all other immigrants, for, you know, to live the American dream, to get freedom from, you know, oppressive places where they left, to have a strong economic future. And what you saw with a lot of immigration to Europe is that Muslims were serving as a, you know, really a form of cheap labor. They were not enculturated into the, they didn't come to be French, to become Belgium. Maybe some of them have, but that the countries have not accepted them on those same terms or made those efforts to integrate them in the same way we try to bring Americanness, American values, American culture to our all the immigrants who come here. And so that leads to a very different circumstance where you have people who really are very disaffected. They don't feel allegiance to the state. They have questions about their identity and whether they belong. And to them, this ideology that ISIS is espousing, you know, has more attraction, whereas in the United States, yes, you have individuals here and there who latch onto it. It's a big country. That happens. But it's not a movement in any sort of way like it's been in Europe.
And again, I'm speaking with David Schanzer, who's a professor of the practice and director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security in the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. And he served as a special counsel to the Office of the General Counsel at the Department of Defense and a trial attorney for the United States Department of Justice. And David, you have studied the Muslim American communities in this country for the past 8 years and their relationship with the police and et cetera. And it's always struck me that in many ways, arguably, Muslim Americans are the first line of defense, because no Christian or Jew can dissuade a young Muslim who's about to take a radical path. The only person who could do that is what we usually refer to as a moderate Muslim. And these are the very people in this country that Donald Trump and Ted Cruz are insulting, but they're the very people that we should really empower and actually be grateful for in terms of their ability to both detect what's going on in their community and also, you know, dissuade people from taking this radical path, because it seems to be a very individual thing.
Well, I agree, and it's true on so many different levels. I mean, on the first level, you know, some people find this ironic, but, you know, what we really want are strong, educated, well-versed Muslim Americans, which means having vibrant institutions, vibrant educational, religious institutions, because people who have a, you know, really firm grounding in Islam are the ones who understand that everything ISIS says is so inconsistent with what they've been taught. So many of the people, you know, that we find, especially in the U.S., you know, you find people who say, "Oh, well, I converted to Islam two months ago," and then all of a sudden, you know, they are engaging in violence. So that's a, you know, the first important threshold. And then, you know, you want people who are, you know, deeply integrated into society, have strong relationships like many other communities do with police and local government and other institutions, so they can, you know, access the safety net when they have, you know, kids who are headed down the wrong pathway, maybe people who have mental health problems, that people who are acting out, looking for something bigger than themselves, they're dissatisfied with the way their life is going. Yeah, you need people who feel like they can connect to something. And then finally, when you really have a problem, you have an individual who, you know, you actually have some thoughts that might engage in violence, you want people to feel comfortable enough and feel confident enough to, you know, connect with the authorities and bring that troublesome person to the attention of law enforcement. So for all those reasons, we want to, you know, honor, respect, and include our Muslim American communities in our the broader American community and make them feel firm, secure, safe, and that's the best way to fight against terrorism.
And given that at least Salah Abdel Salam, who was captured recently, and subsequent to his capture, there was a shootout at another apartment where two people escaped, left behind a lot of bomb making material, and prior to Salah's Abdel Salam's capture, they left his fingerprints were found there, detonators, etc., and that's led them to him. And then the theory is that maybe they moved up this attack. But I think, in fact, that those that escaped from that first police raid there, where an Algerian was shot, might well have been the two that were involved in this bombing. And one of them, of course, has had come back from Iraq. The Turkish authorities, he was deported to the Netherlands. The Turkish authorities had told the Dutch authorities that he was a dangerous jihadi with battle experience with ISIS, but they couldn't hold him. So whereas here in the United States, they basically, if you join ISIS and come back, they arrest you, don't they?
Yes. I'm not an expert on Europe's laws. But when I hear things like this, I scratch my head because I'm like, absolutely. We have a law in the United States. It's called Material Support for Terrorism. It's been upheld by the Supreme Court. And basically what it says, if you do anything, if you write a check for $15 or you provide a laptop computer or you provide labor assistance to a foreign terrorist organization, you have committed a crime that has a penalty of minimum penalty of 15 years in prison. So anybody that they have evidence of that was actually fighting on behalf of an Al Qaeda affiliate or on ISIS, I think if our FBI had that kind of evidence, they'd be wrapping those people up and bringing them to trial, and they'd be arresting them, and they wouldn't be able to get out while they awaited trial. So Europe needs to toughen up its laws in that regard. It needs to put more resources. You keep hearing about, we're tracking a small country and we've got 1,500 people that we're tracking. And these are, serious individuals, not people who've just made Facebook posts, like I think some of the people who are being watched closely in this country. So you've got people who are, hardened criminals who have evidence that they have deeply radicalized, and they're having trouble monitoring all them. Well, that's going to require a reallocation of resources, the kind that we saw in this country after 9/11, and that's across the board in Europe, in all the different countries. So we get a counterterrorism network that is much more robust.
Well, if this AP report, based on French and Iraqi intelligence, that there are up to 400, some they said before between 500 and 600, trained jihadis from ISIS who've been seeded in with the refugee flow and now basically, ticking time bombs in Europe, they're waiting to coalesce around spectacular bloody incidents. And then contrast that with the fact that the Turks warned the Dutch authorities that the guy that they were deporting was a jihadi, and he was released because of lack of evidence. Is that what Tony Blair is referring to as flabby liberalism?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's the idea that we have individuals who have been identified as problematic, who've been have actual connections with foreign terrorist organizations, and the laws are not robust enough to keep that individual in detention. Flabby liberalism, it's something. It's naivete. It is a failure to essentially adapt your laws to the circumstances under which you're living in. I don't think there's a huge principle of liberty that is at stake. I think it is just a it's something that needs to be done in a very robust way. I don't know how to term it, but I think, and I don't want to speculate about 400 individuals in a wave of bloody attacks, because I do have confidence in our democracy and the democracies of Europe to rise up to this challenge and be stoic and face up and do what needs to be done.
Well, in terms of the journey that this Saleh Abdeslam, the fellow that's in custody, who may have been the reason why this attack was sped up and executed in Belgium. He apparently was a petty criminal, like a lot of these guys, like the Paris attackers, like the Charlie Hebdo attackers. They have a similar profile. They're petty criminals, and he was arrested. And then both his family and his neighbors and the kids that grew up with him in Molenbeek in Brussels say that when he came out of prison, he was a different person. He was radicalized. And there is a phenomenon known as Prislam here in the United States, where, we have the largest prison population in the world. And if you go into a prison, if you're white, you might well need to be protected by the Aryan Brotherhoods. If you're Mexican, the Mexican mafia will protect you. And if you're an African-American, the black Muslims will protect you. And this phenomenon has been studied, not particularly well. I don't know whether you've studied it, but is this at play here in Europe, where petty criminals go into a prison as petty criminals and come out as jihadis?
There's definitely been things written about prison radicalization, and you can understand how that occurred, how that can occur. Of about the 300 individuals who have been arrested, Muslim Americans, that is, for terrorism offenses since 9/11, so around 25 per year, very few of them had spent time in prison. So it's not a widespread phenomenon here. I don't purport to know the differences between our criminal justice system and our penal system and that in Europe. But given that the Muslim population is so much larger, especially and so much more concentrated in places like Paris and in Belgium, this is an issue that the authorities are going to have to, again, also invest in, and to keep certain people separated, to make sure there is a healthy cleric establishment inside the prisons that can, teach people about what Islam is, and to resist these radicalization narratives. It's a difficult task, but again, I don't think we've seen that on a widespread basis here at all. And the authorities in Europe are going to have to learn how to try to prevent that phenomenon when they're incarcerating people. But the key, really, is to go well before that. And, they're going to need to bring jobs and education to these poor neighborhoods. Terrorism is not caused by economic deprivation, but a lot of the conditions that people are facing there are certainly ones that can breed isolation, disassociation with the state, and be parts of the grievance narrative that leads people to radicalization. So you're going to have to really begin to have a long-term effort to integrate these communities much better into the countries they live in.
Well, just in closing, David Chancer, you mentioned that ISIS is suffering setbacks, and it would seem to me logical that since terrorism itself is asymmetrical warfare, that the more setbacks they suffer, the more they will probably try to strike back at the West through soft targets in Europe. But at the end of the day, my understanding is that you can't beat terrorism with weapons and military efforts, assets and tactics. That just as you can't have a war on terrorism because it's a tactic, not. And so my sense is that why don't we consider one of the main progenitors of radicalism in Islam, which is the Saudi Arabian Wahhabi version of Islam, which has been funded by petrodollars and spread all around the world. It's very identifiable, and yet somehow or other, although the president in his recent interview in The Atlantic did allude to his frustration with the Saudis, is there any way that you can go after the source?
Well, I think that has to be part of our long-term solution. I mean, I disagree that military power has no role in counterterrorism. ISIS has to be rolled back and defeated. It has to have its territory taken away from it. We have to have, you know, legitimate nation states that are governing territory, or else you're going to have a spread of really what is a cancer throughout the Middle East. But that said, I certainly agree with you that the genesis of all these problems are the ideology itself. And, you know, countries like Saudi Arabia have to, I think, have the choice be put to them a little more starkly than any administration has done in the past, which is, you know, you can have an alliance with the West and you can have economic interest with the West, but you have to do much more to adhere to, I'm not talking about Western values, I'm talking about universal values of tolerance and pluralism and respect for the rule of law, and that has to be taught, and you can't be spreading this ideology that advocates and glorifies death in the name of religion. That is not what the modern world is about. So I think in some ways the Obama administration's refusal to essentially do the Saudis' bidding in ways that I think American foreign policy has done much more in the past 25 years than has been in the last seven is a step in the right direction. But I think, you know, I think Saudi has to ask whether it wants to be a true ally and true part of this coalition of the modern world, or they want to stick to those old customs. And, you know, that's a choice they're going to have to make.
Well, David Chancellor, I thank you very much for joining us.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with David Chancellor, who's a professor of the practice and director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security in the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. He served as a special counsel to the Office of General Counsel at the Department of Defense and a trial attorney for the United States Department of Justice. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Ted Cruz's Assembly of Advisors.
Out the road when he get dough was horrible. Time is money, spend, waste, save, invest, a fest. The 10K cave, a chicken chest, S. Yes, y'all are double, get your trickles. The best ballers pitch in and rub to get a nickels. But tut tut, he bout to change the price again. It go up each time, he blow up like hydrogen. Villain here, albums shrilling in fear. It won't stop top bill until he a gazillionaire. Villain, his agenda is clear. Ending this year with dividends to spare here. A new meaning to sales through the roof.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Michael Hiltzik, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times. He writes the twice-weekly column Golden State, which covers business and economic issues, and his books include The New Deal and Modern History. And his latest article at the Los Angeles Times is Ted Cruz just named Phil Graham his economic advisor. Here's Graham's economic legacy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Hiltzik.
Thank you, Ian. It's good to be back with you.
And, Michael, it's pretty clear the so-called Republican establishment is desperately casting about and hoping that Ted Cruz can somehow come up with some delegate magic to stop the Trump juggernaut. But it seems highly unlikely, given Trump's lead in the delegates and the fact that he's going to pick up a lot of delegates in the Northeast and in places like Wisconsin, et cetera. It's just highly unlikely that cruises are simply going to be able to make it unless they can pull off some kind of stunt at the convention in Cleveland. So with that caveat that maybe we're talking about somebody who's not going to be president, nevertheless, today Jeb Bush endorsed him. What do you think that's going to do for Cruz?
Well, I don't know if it'll do much of anything. Jeb Bush obviously was not the first choice of many people, many Republicans, voting in the primaries. It certainly looks to me and many other observers that Bush is just throwing in his lot with Cruz as a way to slow down Donald Trump. But as you said, it's unclear certainly that Cruz can get to the convention with a majority of delegates. The question is, will he be strong enough to have clout if the Republican convention goes to a brokered convention and pass the first ballot? So it's anybody's guess, but he's certainly at this point a major factor in the race, one way or the other.
Well, in terms of his advisors, you've written, of course, about Phil Gramm, who is named as his economic advisor, and he's has been named, I think, by most people in a kind of consensus way as the single individual perhaps most responsible for the 2008 crash, at least for laying down the pathway, if you will. But just in terms of who he's already chosen for in terms of his foreign policy team, he's got Elliot Abrams from the Iran-Contra infamy, Michael Ledeen, one of the big salesmen for the Iraq war and a huge advocate for war with Iran. And then, of course, he's got this wacko Islamophobe, Frank Gaffney, the man who believed that Saddam Hussein was behind the Oklahoma City bombing and warned against the infiltration of the American government, including the Republican Party, by members of the Muslim Brotherhood. So is it just because there aren't any good people left that want to go join up with Trump and Cruz? Is that why it's not like they're getting anywhere near the A or B team? We're talking about the D and F team here.
Well, I think as I made the point in talking about Gramm, these are all people who share a worldview with Ted Cruz. And I think one thing you can say for Cruz is that he probably has he's probably devoted somewhat more thought to his worldview than Trump has to his own. But that doesn't mean it's necessarily palatable. I mean, all the people that you named as his foreign policy advisors, these are all characters from the right-wing neoconservative camp who led us into war in the Mideast, who have this peculiarly unnuanced view as to who the enemy is and what's going on in Iran and Iraq and the rest of the region. These are all familiar names. I think to somebody with the worldview of Ted Cruz, this is the A-team. It's the A-team of militaristic Islamophobia. So it's not surprising any more than it's particularly surprising that he would tap somebody like Phil Gramm as his economic advisor. This is all harking back to the bad old days of the aughty-aughts, of the George W. Bush team, and even in economic terms, even further back than that, to the 1980s, 1990s, the era when Enron and the banks were just running roughshod over the economy and before the real consequences of that became evident to many people.
Yeah, but that's the hard part to understand is why do you choose people who have – it's like the opposite of embellishing a resume. These people have, nuclear-style black holes in their resume that have caused massive destruction, like the 2008 crash, like Enron that took the taxpayers down for, $60 billion. And Phil Gramm's wife, of course, was on the board and received, something like a couple of million dollars in compensation. It's almost like an anti-resume, isn't it?
Well, it is to you and it is to me.
Right.
I think to the people who Ted Cruz really does represent, His wife was an executive at Goldman Sachs until she took a leave to help him run his campaign. These are people that the people who Cruz is trying to appeal to are those who think that that the run up at least to the crash in 2008 was just fine for them, and it was. And then, you know, in their self-deluded way, they're looking at the crash of 2008 and the consequent recession as somebody else's fault. They love to blame the Democrats. They like to blame blacks and Hispanics who wanted to buy houses. They don't ever blame themselves. If they did, they wouldn't be they wouldn't have led us down that road in the first place. So so I think to them, going back to the 1980s and early 1990s is something that's good. It's the era in which they felt flush and they thought they were going to get rich. And you know, sorry about the economy and what happened in 2008, but they don't regard that as their fault. Phil Graham, in particular, you know, in interviews that he gave after the crash and after the recession, was unapologetic about his role. He was unapologetic about the policies that he pursued and fomented at, in the Senate, this incredible deregulation. He thought that was all to the good.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Hiltzik, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times. He writes the twice-weekly column Golden State, and he's the author of The New Deal, A Modern History, and his latest article at the LA Times is Ted Cruz Just Named Phil Graham His Economic Advisor. Here's Graham's economic legacy. And in terms of his economic legacy, though, the worst, I mean, the genesis of the crash in many ways, and it still sort of haunts us today with this sort of dark money, these unregulated markets that are out there, all of these derivatives. He fought tooth and nail against Brooksley Bourne, who was appointed by Clinton to chair the CFTC, appears to have won the day with her, creating what effectively and has been called the Enron loophole, which means that these multi-trillion-dollar OTC derivative market was removed from any regulation. And that's pretty clearly the pathway to the 2008 crash. And it still, to some extent, haunts us today, because even Hillary Clinton has been warning about this sort of, I can't remember what she calls it, the dark money or unregulated, or she calls it shadow banking.
Shadow banking.
Yeah.
System.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say, you know, Phil Graham, he was such an intense advocate of deregulation, not only of derivatives, but everything else in the financial system, but particularly of derivatives, that he wanted to go further than even Enron, who was his patron, wanted. This was in the run-up. This was in preparation for something called the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which was going to essentially deregulate a lot of the activities that the CFTC, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which, as you said, was headed for many years by Graham's wife, Wendy Graham. Graham introduced, who was one of the sponsors of this Commodity Futures Modernization Act that deregulated things so far, and the bill actually got stalled in the Senate because he had introduced it, but he wanted it to be even more oriented toward deregulation, and that led to Enron, which was going to be one of the great beneficiaries of this bill, complaining about him, saying that he was such an intense advocate of going further than the bill as written was going to go, that he was holding it up, and they wanted this provision that deregulated electricity futures. And we know about electricity futures and Enron here in California because Enron's activities cost us billions of dollars.
$60 billion. I was told $60 billion. I was told by the head of the Senate up in Sacramento.
Well, I think that's probably right in the ballpark.
Right.
So Graham eventually, you know, in 2000, he did get this bill through. It was signed into law by Bill Clinton as one of Clinton's very last acts in as president. Not something that he should be proud of, obviously, but there was a lot of deregulation going on during the Clinton administration that was being pushed by Republican Congress.
And that's pretty mystifying, isn't it, that Bill Clinton, on his way out the door, when normally in the end, and we're seeing this with Barack Obama, now that he's a lame duck, he's standing up on principle on a number of issues. And you know, damn the torpedoes, I'm just going to get this done against opposition. It seems the opposite with Bill Clinton. He had, you know, no good reason to do this, did he, in terms of his legacy, which is blown up in his face. He could have been tougher on them, couldn't he?
Yes, as you said, it was fairly mysterious. There was a lot that went on in those last months of the Clinton administration that was curious. You'll remember that he also pardoned Mark Rich, who was a fugitive commodities trader who I think had fled the U.S. and ended up in Switzerland. And he got pardoned by Clinton, and this was something that I think is still controversial even today, because, you know, Rich really, it was a reason that he ended up in Switzerland is because it's because he didn't want to face the music here in the U.S. for his commodity trading. But so yeah, there is that during you know, Brooksley Bourne's efforts to bring derivatives under jurisdiction, under her jurisdiction, was defeated by Clinton appointees, Bob Rubin and later Larry Summers as Treasury Secretary, Arthur Levitt as head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, Alan Greenspan at the Fed. They ganged up on Bourne and got her to back off her efforts to bring these over-the-counter derivatives that were not traded on exchanges, and that ended up causing all sorts of, at least being at the center of all sorts of imprudent behavior by investment banks and commercial banks. She wanted them all to be traded on an exchange. She wanted them standardized so that everybody had an idea as to how much was out there, and it's something that we really didn't know, and I think still don't know, because they're still not regulated.
Well, just in closing, I've been did a little analysis yesterday of Donald Trump's team, and it's pretty clear that he's not attracting any real talent. But on the other hand, you know, he's a one man show, and it's almost like he wouldn't even want to have a vice president. Certainly not anybody that was competent, because they might compete with him. I mean, is that motivating him? That appears to be ego seems to be motivating him. But I don't understand what's motivating. You're saying in Cruz's case, it's just pure ideology. Because he says things like policing Muslim neighborhoods, which are just so outrageous. Everybody tells me that he's a really smart guy. So is this guy incredibly cynical? Does he know something that we don't know? Are we just sort of outraged liberals on the sidelines, sort of hyperventilating, and while he's doing something clever?
I don't know. You know, it's hard to define intelligence in this case. Look, everybody who knows Ted Cruz personally, yes, they say that, you know, in terms of brain power, he's intelligent. They also say that he's unprincipled and that he is cynical. And I think that's one reason why you find that so many of his colleagues in the Senate have avoided endorsing him up to now, when he's seen maybe as the only alternative to Donald Trump. But look, certainly in the Republican primaries, Cruz knows, you know, he's identified his target audience, he's identified his target market, and these appointments are really part of his way of appealing to that wedge of the Republican primary electorate. You know, I think we've seen in many other contexts that that the primaries, and particularly the Republican primaries, bring out an extreme electorate, and candidates who want to win in those primaries have to appeal to the extreme wing, to the point that once once they become the nominee, if they do become the nominee, there just isn't enough time left in the universe, in the life of the universe, for them to scurry back to the center. And we saw that, certainly we saw that in 2010 here in California when Meg Whitman, the former CEO of eBay, was running for the Republican nomination for governor. Carly Fiorina was running to be the Republican nominee for U.S. Senator. And they ended up taking such extreme right-wing positions so that they could win the Republican nominations that they could not shed them when the time came to move back to the middle and run in the general election. I think that certainly, I think that happened to Mitt Romney in the presidential election the last time around. I think it's certainly going to happen to whoever the victor is in the GOP primaries for president this time around.
Sure, except that Donald Trump is an exception. Nothing seems to matter with him.
Well, it's going to matter. Look, if you look at the numbers,
right.
Donald Trump is appealing, let's say he's appealing to 40%, 40-some-odd percent of the Republican primary electorate, which is a subset of the Republican, of the total
sure.
Republican electorate. Now, if you translate that to what's his real standing mm-hmm. in the United States when it comes to a general election, you look at that and you say, well, you know, it's going to be 20% and maybe mm-hmm. even less by the time, you know, assuming he gets the nomination and he's got to run for president.
Well, Michael Hilsing, so, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
All right. It's my pleasure.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Michael Hilsing, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times. He writes a twice-weekly column, Golden State, which covers business and economic issues, and he's the author of The New Deal in Modern History. And his latest article at the LA Times is Ted Cruz just named Phil Graham his economic advisor. Here's Graham's economic legacy. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the results from last night's primaries and whether a movement that has coalesced around Bernie Sanders will become a potent political force in the future. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Bill Zimmerman, who's an author, longtime activist, and one of the nation's most experienced political media consultants. Previously, he was a strategic communications consultant to MoveOn.org and is the author of Troublemaker, a memoir from the front lines of the 60s. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bill Zimmerman.
Thank you, Ian.
And what do you make of this, the fact that Bernie Sanders won very decisively by 75% of the votes in both the caucuses in Idaho and Utah, and Hillary, of course, won equally decisively in Arizona. But at the end of the day, Bernie Sanders netted 76 delegates to Hillary's 55 delegates, yet everybody is more or less saying that Hillary's got it in the bag.
Well, I think the pundits have been saying that from the beginning in an attempt to undermine Sanders' support. I think the diagnosis of his demise is a little premature. It certainly looks as though Hillary has a better shot at the nomination, but it's too soon to discount the possibility of Sanders winning. More interesting, though, I think, is to talk not about political outcomes, which are always very difficult to predict, but what would happen after the election. Bernie Sanders has said throughout his campaigning that the kinds of changes he wants to make in the country cannot happen without a political revolution. He is accumulating an extraordinary base of support. You know, when Obama got elected in 2008, he had 13 million names of people who had contributed to him. And a lot of us were disappointed that those 13 million names were not turned into a political organization with muscle and instead were used for fundraising. Sanders has far more than 13 million names. Probably he will wind up with triple that amount. So he has the potential, whether he's elected or not, to work and organize the political revolution that he's been talking about. Whether he'll do it or not is another question, but there's enormous potential in having raised this movement in support of a presidential candidate and what you can do with that movement, even if you don't win the presidency. You know, MoveOn.org, which I helped build during the administration of George W. Bush, became a very important political entity because it was able to eventually rise to about 5 million members. MoveOn, since Obama's election, has not been as powerful a political entity as it was before because they never really figured out how to deal with a friend in the White House. They didn't go along with everything that Obama did and is doing, but they supported his election and they basically support his presidency. So they were stuck not figuring out how to deal with somebody as the loyal opposition. Sanders has solved that problem. He has been critical of Hillary and by inference of the establishment Democrats and has found a language and a rhetoric that half the Democratic Party seems to be responding to. So there's potential to go on after the election, whether he wins or loses, and forge an organization with political muscle and fantastic fundraising capability that could do a variety of things after the election to build toward the political revolution that he's been talking about prior to the election.
Well, a lot of the wins, for example, he's had are not getting a lot of attention. Bernie Sanders won the Democrats abroad primary by a margin of 69% to 31%. And a lot of people have argued that the path ahead for him is getting better and better. And that's a similar argument that I hear on Donald Trump's side, that he's likely to get to the 1237 delegates because the Northeast is going to vote in Wisconsin. And I think he's got to win 56% of the vote from now on, which is very doable. Kasich is completely delusional. He doesn't have a chance mathematically. And Cruz has an extremely long shot chance. So that seems to be the math on the Republican side. As far as I can tell, on the Democratic side, there could be a path ahead. Saturday, you've got Alaska, Hawaii, and Washington. Aren't all of those likely to go for Bernie?
Yes, they are. And you know, there is a path to victory, but it's a difficult one, given the lead that Hillary has and given the hold that she has on the superdelegates. Because this isn't just about the committed delegates. There are also hundreds of superdelegates, and their propensity to support Hillary is obvious. So Bernie has two hurdles to cross. He's got to continue to win the majority of the delegates going forward, and he's got to then convince the superdelegates to come over to his side. That's a tall order. It's not impossible, but neither is it likely that he's going to prevail.
Again, I'm speaking with Bill Zimmerman, who's an author, longtime activist, and one of the nation's most experienced political media consultants. Previously, he was a strategic communications consultant to MoveOn.org and is the author of Troublemaker, a memoir from the front lines of the 60s. So what about the other possibility that's floated, that he could be a VP, the theory being that the young people that support Bernie are pretty passionate? And I've interviewed a couple, and some have said, you know, if it's not Bernie, no way I'm voting for Hillary. Hillary does have negatives. And frankly, again, it does seem once again that the Democrats are counting on winning because the other side has put up an absolute train wreck, or likely to put up a train wreck. Even in that scenario, just to finish, that scenario, Bernie polls better than Hillary against Donald Trump.
Yes, and he has from the beginning. But you know, you when you think about or when you ask about a vice presidential nomination, you have to remember that this isn't a national popular election. This is an election in the Electoral College, which means 50 separate state elections. So whoever wins, if Hillary wins the nomination and she's selecting a vice presidential nominee, she and her campaign people are going to look very closely at the Electoral College vote. Which states can they prevail in, and can they put together a majority in the Electoral College? Now, it may turn out that Bernie on the ticket would be very helpful in a few critical states. Michigan is certainly one example. Michigan is pretty much a must-win state for the Democrats. And Hillary lost to Bernie in Michigan. So if Michigan is critical, then that might be something to consider. Generally, the two most important states are Ohio and Florida in terms of making those Electoral College estimates. I don't know that Bernie brings a lot to the ticket in those two states. But they aren't the only two states, and Trump could put other states in play that normally are reliably blue. So the calculation is going to be made on the basis of how she can do in the states that are critical to putting that Electoral College together, majority together. That may involve Bernie, it may not.
So the other choice that's mentioned, one of the Castro brothers, who's the secretary of HUD, does that do any good in terms of the big states, Florida and Ohio?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I think Bernie's role after the election, if he doesn't win, needs to be appreciated in terms of everything that Elizabeth Warren has been able to do from a Senate seat. I think Bernie can be more valuable in terms of his own agenda of building that political revolution by organizing his supporters post-election. I think he can do that more effectively from a Senate seat where he's politically independent and can say what he wants than being part of a Clinton administration in which he is bound to support the president in most of the policies. I think that would encumber the building of a political revolution. So I doubt you're going to see him going in that direction.
And Elizabeth Warren has often been mentioned as a possible running mate for Hillary. That does seem sort of counterintuitive to have a double barrel shot at the glass ceiling?
Well, it would be very interesting to have two female candidates on the ticket. That would certainly be precedent setting. But, if it's important to draw that Bernie Sanders constituency in for the general election, Elizabeth Warren could do it just as easily as Bernie.
So is there a sort of time lag in American politics? I mean, the point that you made earlier about Obama getting this extraordinary list of supporters together and then essentially doing nothing about it, once he got the job of president, he didn't sustain the movement. And that Bernie has an even bigger list and he's likely to sustain a movement beyond this election. That's always puzzled me. For example, when Richard Nixon ended the Vietnam War, that massive student movement, which was more than students, of course, that huge political movement simply evaporated. But in terms of traditional politics, arguably when Goldwater lost, 16 years later, Reagan won on a Goldwater platform. And in fact, I always recall Reagan's speech at the 76 convention when Ford got the nod by a hair, and then Reagan made an extraordinarily powerful speech that blew Ford out of the water. And it was like everybody was saying, my God, we got the wrong guy. And then a few years later, they get the right guy. So does it take a while? And, of course, they could throw into the mix Nixon's comeback.
Well, it takes a long time sometimes, you know, so long that I would actually dispute what you said earlier about the anti-war movement dissipating so rapidly in 75 when the war ended. I think instead that the people who had participated in the anti-war movement then seeded all the other movements that rose up at the time. The gay liberation, the environmental movement, the continuation of the women's movement. It was the 60s activists that played a role in expanding those movements and keeping them alive during the dark years when Reagan and the Republicans dominated the public discourse in this country. But, you know, the difference between Obama in 08 and Bernie Sanders in 2016 is the difference between someone whose agenda was to work through electoral politics and someone whose agenda is to build a political revolution and who has experience as an organizer. So I think we can look for much more from Sanders in terms of creating a post-election agenda. And, you know, there are a variety of things that he can do. He's got enormous fundraising capability that's been demonstrated. So he could be running or helping to fund progressive Democrats in primaries against conservative Democrats. You know, the DNC in Washington and the organizations that it supports, like the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee and the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, those entities tend to support very conservative Democrats when they're lining up a ticket for a ballot for challenging Republicans. They support conservative Democrats because they get their money from a lot of the same people who fund Republican campaigns. If Sanders were to step up and say, wait a second, I can fund as easily, perhaps with not as much money, but certainly with sufficient money, I can fund progressive Democratic candidates running for office. That would be one direction he might go in to try to move power away from the traditional DNC apparatus and set up an alternative. He could also establish an activist organization that would be comparable to what MoveOn.org was during the George W. Bush administration. Activists that would try to carry out his agenda by making public demands for a single-payer health care system or campaign finance reform. So I think there's both a wider range of options available to Sanders because he has more names and more money than Obama had. But also, he's a very different person. He's been a political organizer all his life, and he's pursuing a long-term rather than a short-term agenda. So I think we can look for much more from Sanders than we got from Obama.
Well, Bill Zimmerman, I thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Bill Zimmerman, who's an author, longtime activist, and one of the nation's most experienced political media consultants. Previously, he was a strategic communication consultant to MoveOn.org and is the author of Troublemaker, a memoir from the front lines of the 60s. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. We'll be right back.